October 12, 2008, lecture discussion number 62 on Genesis 1 through 19. Okay, last Sunday I got a little rushed, and I spoke in shortened phrases, inside baseball if you want, a technical jargon. I tried to speed up and finish on time. That was my plan. So when it gets close to the end, I start pushing a little bit. And I instinctively resorted to the assumptions, because I know most of you. I just hope that everyone understood what I meant and what I intended, and that was obviously not the case, as I wondered about the room, called working the room, and collecting tithes and offerings type stuff. It's what us pastors do. It's professionalism. Anyway, it wasn't the case, and it thus behooves us to at least go back over the skipped over pages that I left out. And by the way, behoove is one of my favorite words. I got that from Foghorn Leghorn, as he was always behooving. If you remember Foghorn, and he has that great Southern Baptist voice that I need to perfect. Anyway, it behooves us to go back, and so we're going to revisit and we're going to reword some of last week's lecture before we take off or move forward. And yes, we do move, and yes, we do move forward. But first, as promised, I want to begin your first. Well, it's not really your first. It's not really our first either. Certainly not my first. It's not really the first at all. Anyway, what I'll call it is the repetition of a previous beginning. That's what it'll be. And it's something that I'm going to try to do because I recognize the need to do it, especially in this today's environment. And I want to start introducing simultaneous with these other subjects that we're going to in today, Genesis 15, these little short dissertations or snippets. I used to do this 15, 20 years ago when I was preoccupied with these subjects. And I would constantly bring them up and inflict them on my classes or my friends or my co-workers or passers-by. I was well known for bringing these things up in lunchroom settings at Alyeska Pipeline. It got to the point where nobody sat with me, and I didn't take it personally. It was really fun to walk up with my tray and watch people go, boom, and I would sit down. I consider that kind of a badge of honor, but I got to be known for doing this all the time, and so I'm going to start bringing them back again, starting again pretty much over, I guess. So think of these as kind of transitional, or transitory, somewhat a bridge to gap, to take over the gap or wherever we plan to go after we exit Genesis 1 through 19. And I'm going to try to include them every Sunday morning. And they're only going to be a couple of three pages, which makes them what? About an hour or so. It's not a problem. But I think they're critical. I really think they're critical for you today. You'll see it on television. We saw it on television with regard to our governor. I'll bring that up in a minute. But she was mocked on one of these comedy programs, and the comment made to her was, let's ask this one about dinosaurs. I'll bring it up again. In other words, the implication is that Christians who talk about dinosaurs are what? Yeah, is stupid. Can't say it any easier than that. Certainly ignorant. All of them are. And that's very distressing to me, because we should be the opposite of that. Anyway, I think they're critical for you to be able to define. I think they're absolutely critical for you to be able to discuss, especially with your families. So think of this as kid-friendly. Invite your children for the short subject before each one of these sermons that's going to be coming. Think of these as you will, if you will, as Berean skepticisms. And I hope you see how that ties into what I said a little bit last week. Acts 17:10 is Berea, is where it's brought up, and it's a town where Jewish scholars live there. And that many believed when Paul came. Paul would go to the synagogue and he would argue topics with these Jewish scholars in city after city. He would go to the Jews first, and
And they believed because of what he said. But first, before they believed, they did something. They compared what he said to the scriptures. They searched the scriptures. If it was in the Bible, or if it was in what they would call the Torah, the Old Testament, if it was in the Holy Scriptures, and it could be proved by the Holy Scriptures, then it was true. And if it was not proved by the scriptures, it was not true. And they didn't believe Paul. They said, hey, that sounds good. We'll check it out. And that's what I want you to be, as a Berean skeptic. So here we are. Here's your short subject material today for you to talk to your kids about. And every lecture that I used to do in school, you start out defining vocabularies, if it wasn't vocabulary words, if it wasn't a math class. Here is your first word that you need to know, permineralize. Define permineralize. Pronounce permineralized. What subject am I in? I am in paleontology, yes. I am in the study of fossils. Permineralized, it means the rock materials have been deposited into all the spaces within an original bone. In other words, a bone is in a waterborne substrate of some kind, or a waterborne environment. It has been covered by mud, or it is in a mineral spirit lake or body of water. And so I have water and I have mineralization. And so permineralization is a process. A non-technical way of explaining it, or an explanation, may be to state that a bone is encased in this water mineral deposit or environment, and over a period of time, the bone is replaced by the minerals. And what do we call that? We call that a fossil. So in other words, the bone is no longer bone. It looks like the bone. A duplicate copy of the bone has been made, and it is mineral. It is rock. And over time, the rock replaces the bone and gives you a Xerox copy of it. But it isn't bone. It's rock. Does that make sense? That's called permineralization. Okay? So go home and practice that. Do not have a large tongue. When Sarah Palin was asked, what do you think about dinosaurs? And, I admire anybody that will go through the process that she's going through. That is an everyday, all-day beating by people that hate you. That's no fun. And that's no fun on either side. But I particularly wanted her to begin saying things like, well, I've studied the permineralization process. Right there, she wins. When somebody asks you, you're Christians, you go to church, when somebody asks you, well, what do you think about dinosaurs? You're in the permineralization process. That's what you do. That's why it's so important that you know. Okay, first you have to understand what it is. There really are three ways fossils are found today. One is the formations of impressions. You did this in class when you were a kid. You got a bunch of clay and you had a toy soldier. And you made an impression, you pulled it apart, took the toy soldier out, and what did you have? The impression of the toy. You didn't have the toy soldier. A fossil is not the exact material. It is an impression. Sometimes you have permineralization, which I just explained, and then you have carbonization, which is essentially an ink picture of it. In other words, it's been encased, and then when you pull the material away, you see a carbon track of it, an ink picture. Now, they're very, very detailed. We could get a tremendous amount of information about the animal or the leaf or whatever it was that was put in there and became some sort of fossil. So, permineralization, same as mineralization, also called phosphatization. So those are your vocabulary words right off the bat. Now, your second one that I want you to know, and again, you ask me about dinosaurs, you ask me a mocking question about what do I think of dinosaurs, I'm going to say back to you, we're in a discussion of the rate of time of fossils, and we're also in a discussion of the Medusa effect. You need to know what the Medusa effect is. Right off the bat, who's Medusa? See, if you touched or saw Medusa, you were turned instantly into stone. What do you now know about fossilization with regard to the Medusa? Do you ever hear the Medusa effect discussed in any of these debates? No, you never do. The Medusa effect is a fossil that occurs what? Almost instantly. We have fossils that are produced almost instantaneously. So now we're in a discussion on the rate at which fossilization occurs. Okay? So far, I'm assuming that you have deduced that the subject, the short transitionatory subject we're in here, is the age of the Earth, or the creation and the place that I put dinosaurs. By the way, did the Chinese call them dinosaur? No, they call them animals. Okay? They don't think they're unusual at all. And we need to begin to understand the mocking that is coming towards the church with regard to this subject. But that's what we're doing, is we're in creation evolution, aren't we? The next thing you need to know is mummification. And if you can just pronounce these words, you'll be in great shape. That'll stop almost every argument. People will back away from you slowly, because you're not an easy target anymore. That's what I have. That's my difficulty with Governor Palin. Is she went into an arena and she was not ready. She was an easy target. Now, I admire her greatly, as most of you know. She's done things that I think are profound with regard to the pro-life issue, and I'm very proud of her. And I'm in no way trying to criticize her. Don't think so. But if I were on her side, if she would contacted me, I would have said to go into New York City and talk to these folks who hate Christians because of what they believe with regard to creation and the issue of life, is to put yourself in very difficult straits. And please be ready. Please be able to pronounce permineralization. Phosphatization. Know the Medusa effect. Understand mummification. Mummification is the preservation or the drying of by actions of chemicals. In other words, I can mummify something. It's not a fossil, it's a mummy. I can mummify something. If I put it in asphalt or tar or amber, you remember Jurassic Park, right? I have a very ancient bug that had in it the blood of a dinosaur, because, and it was encased in amber for a trillion years. I'm kidding. Why not? Why not a trillion or a quadrillion? So if I can bury it in asphalt or tar or amber or oil, I can mummify it. It's got to happen quickly. It's got to be completely encased, but it can be mummified. Or ice. It can be frozen. In other words, I can find ice is of particular interest here, isn't it? Because we're in Alaska. I can find ice fields, and inside ice fields are what? Bones. Bones of what? Mammoths is true, but bones of what? Dinosaurs. I can find, you have to be familiar now, with the Liscum bone bed, where I have thousands of unfossilized dinosaur bones that are frozen. Now, they are they fall into the mummification category and not into the fossilized category. Now, if I have a mummified dinosaur bone, what do I have in it? I have hemoglobin in it. I have all kinds of, I have ligaments. See, we should, it's a special, you know, we need to be familiar with the Liscombe bone bed because it's in Alaska. It's on the North Slope. And we should have a congregational field trip is what we should do. It's a special note because the Liscombe bone bed, as I said, has thousands of unfossilized dinosaur bones. They're frozen in the ice. Now, and as I said, they have ligaments, they have other structures attached to them. And so what is the great issue now? How old are they? How long have they been frozen? Are they a trillion years old? Has the frozen condition that they've been in, it would have to exist for all the way to when they were buried there of some time. What's your explanation? See, how long does it take for that ice system to remain there and to keep, or how long could it possibly have remained there? And then how long does it take for a bone, as I said, to be permineralized? How long does it take for something to be fossilized? And again, let me go back to this. Consider that we have found fossils or mineralization of hats. We have a mineralization of a sack of flour. We have a mineralization of a fence. We have a mineralization of wire. They found all kinds of things that have become mineralized or permineralized. So how long does it take? The point being is that fossilization is time dependent. And the question, of course, then becomes how much time is necessary. So when somebody says, what do you think of dinosaurs? You are in the discussion of how long does it take for something to be fossilized? How long does it take for something to remain in ice, mummified? And this would be a good place to note that paleontologists are discovering partially mineralized, permineralized fossils. In other words, they're still in the process of being mineralized when they are uncovered. So they aren't quite fossilized yet. There's parts of them that are fossilized and parts of them that are not. So the process is interrupted by the paleontologist, by the excavation. The process incomplete. And as I said, we have a Tyrannosaurus rex, whereas they cut the bone apart. Part of the bone is permineralized and part of it is not. And there is hemoglobin in it, as well as other aspects of bone characteristics and makeup. Okay, if I throw an animal into a spring mineral, a mineral spring, it will become mineralized or permineralized in a matter of weeks. It will turn to stone. Medusa effect. So there are mineral springs all over this world. If I take an animal, a dead animal, and make sure it's thrown in there with as quickly as I possibly can, and go down and get it in about 5 or 8 weeks, it will become mineralized. The flesh will have been replaced by a stone duplicate, the Medusa effect. So understanding the process and how they occur and the time requirements, the implications of non-fossilized animals being found, or what we call fresh bones, that becomes very important for the Berean skeptic because, as you know, the evolutionary system is the absolute opposite of what? Of the Bible. I look in the Bible for evolution. It is not there. Not only is it not there, it is 100% opposed by what the Bible teaches. So the Berean skeptic at the time of Paul would immediately rule it as what? Untrue. But you have to know what the issue is. I appreciate blind faith, and I have lots of people that come up to me and say, I believe it. I don't know why I believe it. I believe it. That's good enough for me. I don't need to know about this stuff. And my response to you is, I rue the day when your kids come to me. I fear for, you're going to get by. Ignorance is not bliss, by the way, because it affects those around you. Your witness is not even remotely effective. And your number one witness is going to be to who? Your children. And you will be held accountable for that. So don't tell me it isn't important, because when you tell me it isn't important, then I know that you do not think the faith of your children is important, and that is so important to you, I cannot even begin to tell you how you will be held accountable for it, how I will be held accountable for it. We will all be held accountable for what it is our children believe. And great sadness will be there for those who have not protected their children. So what does all this have to do with scams in the church? Because that last week I said that every week I'm going to start dealing with scams in the church. And scams, period. Cons, period. Nothing makes me more frustrated than to go to an event where a con is done, usually as a presentation of entertainment, and have people fall for it. It just drives me nuts. I know it keeps me from enjoying silly things. But it does. It bothers me. And I want to strangle the people in the audience. How can you possibly believe this? What's the matter with you? I want to yell at the guy or the whoever it is. Please, please don't fall for these things, because I want you to be the wise. Now, I know it's bad. I ruined Christmas carols for you, too. I know that. But it's just the way I am. Can't change myself. Don't want to either. I like being a skeptic. I think a cynical skeptic, a bitter cynical skeptic, is very valuable. I really, okay, I'm kidding. Many things are in the same subjects, because what am I telling you? I'm equating the evolutionary fossilization scientific dinosaur blah, blah, blah. What am I calling it? I'm calling it a scam, yeah. Which means I'm saying something about it. I'm saying that it has an agenda. See, the unwise are easily fooled, often by something very simple. And so that's why the Bible tells you to seek wisdom. Now, wisdom is defined by Scripture as that which is about God. It's the truth of God. And so when I see something that is not of God, then I know it has an agenda. What's the agenda of this particular presentation? And it has to be constantly evaluated. When they asked Governor Palin what she thinks about dinosaurs, what was their agenda? What were they trying to do to her or to you or to all of us for that matter? What are they trying to do? What is the purpose of that? So I always ask you, is it truth? Because I get that a lot. I am only here to tell the truth. I just want to bring the truth to the fore. That's what they'll tell me. It's all about truth. We're just constantly digging up the truth. Really. Is it the truth that matters to you? I'll tell you, the truth doesn't matter at all to them. It isn't about truth at all. It's about something else. Because Christ said what? I am the truth. He made sure that you know that that truth is His domain. Truth is the domain of God. So the purpose really comes down to three things. It comes down to political power, sociological control, or money. So money, control, or power. I submit that man always has one of these three in his mind. Therefore, we have to be on guard. If Scripture says otherwise, then it isn't truth that is the motive. It's going to be money, power, or control. And it doesn't really matter the organization. The government will do it. The education system will do it. The business system will do it. The media will do it. The church does it. The church manipulates you with tricks because they are after the truth? No, they are after money, power, or control. The church is, and I say church in a general sense, the church is notorious for doing what? Running scams in order to get money. And we deserve a beating for it. So pay attention. What is it that they're proposing? Is it a doctrine of God or is it a doctrine of man? And if it's a doctrine of man, then it has an agenda. And if searching the scripture makes it obvious that God has declared whatever it is untrue, then it's merely a process of figuring out what the trick is. Now, God says it's untrue and somebody's pushing it down your throat. Now all we got to do is find out what it is, figuring out the trick that makes whatever it is seem to be true. And it's always a trick of some kind, always. And that's why I want you to know what all the tricks are. What am I saying to you? I want you to know what all the tricks are. What am I saying? I'm saying to you there's a finite number of them, isn't it? There's only so many of these things, and they always constantly repeat. All you've got to do is learn them all, and pretty soon you'll start to pick them out. You'll go, oh, that's this. That's that. Oh, that's the... When I was at Alyeska Pipeline, my job was to teach restaurant cons to the slope workers. They called them restaurant cons. What were they really? They called them waitress cons as well, but they were really in the clubs, right? Do I have to get more specific? These guys would come off the slope with thousands and thousands of dollars, and they'd go into these places and they would lose all their money. And so there were certain repeatable tricks that were used in these establishments. And so my job was to get up there and say, this is the Mustang con. This is the dying mother-in-law con. This is the diamond necklace con. And they would all look at me and go, I fell for that one. I went out and even looked at the Mustang. Why was it it used to be a Corvette, but it changes. But there's certain things that they do and they repeat them. The same thing's true in all of these. So we will learn what these tricks are, and then they'll repeat. And pretty soon you will recognize them for what they are. And you will teach your kids, and you will begin a system of armoring yourself with the Bible. Okay, now let's start the sermon. That only took 20 minutes. Next week, we're having a test. I'll leave it on the board. No erasing. Last week, Leviticus 16, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement was last week, right? On the 9th? And so, I just happened to be in Yom Kippur. Now, to remember Leviticus 16, and we did it last week, you could kind of follow along. If you weren't here, you can turn to Leviticus 16. But it's the Day of Atonement, and atonement means to make reparations, to satisfy, usually financially. I atone for breaking your window by giving you what? The cost to replace your window. So Day of Atonement. I wreck your car, I make atonement. So it's to satisfy, it's to pay the price to make reparations for. So that's what the Yom Kippur means. And you remember, I hope, the ashes of the red heifer. The ashes of the red heifer does what? It cleans you from what? You're dirty because you have done what? You have touched a dead person. That's ironic, isn't it? Because what are we? We are dead people walking, right? So we're automatically defiled because we're contacting ourselves. Hold hands with your girlfriend, you got to be cleaned by the ashes of the red heifer because you've touched a walking dead person. Don't touch each other. Won't work. But that's the ashes of the red heifer, cleansing from defilement, unclean because of contact with a dead body, killing another person in battle. You have to be cleansed by the ashes of the red heifer, touching a dead body. The context is dead people. It's the ashes of the red heifer, dead people make the connection. Now the two goats. One goat for YHVH, and this is something I didn't do well last time. I've got two goats, and so we have Where is my... Who do we blame?
Emily.
The Presbyterians. No, I don't know. Okay, we have a goat. We have a goat for YHVH, which is the unpronounceable name of God. We would say Jehovah, Yahweh, one of the others, but it is the ineffable, the unpronounceable name of God. It's not a very good Y. And then the other goat is the goat that is presented. This goat is presented to God. And what does God want it presented to? How does he want it presented? No, he wants it dead. But the other goat is presented to Azazel. Oh. Anyway, that's also a person, and that goat is presented alive. Now, that's very important to know, and I didn't make that very clear. One goat for YHVH, the unpronounceable name. The other name, or the other presented to Azazel. And presented to him. And goat, and the two goats were chosen by lot. He'd reach in and he'd pull out the lot. He'd put the YHVH, he'd put the Azazel. And one goat was chosen and sent to YHVH or Jehovah, and the other goat would be released alive into the to Azazel, where he resided into the wilderness. It had a scarlet cord on its horn, and it was led by a suitable man. So far, so good, right? We're all there still. And the other elements of the atonement ceremony is God said to Aaron, I will appear, and Moses, I will appear above the mercy seat. I will appear there. And it's the Shekinah glory will be there. So when you walk into the Holy of Holies, if you happen to walk in on the Holy of Holies, like say Tuesday, what happened to you? If you were dead. The only time you'd go in there was on this one very special day, Yom Kippur, and he said, I will be there above the mercy seat. He's the Shekinah glory is there. You could see the glow because in the tabernacle it was all covered with skins, right? But you could see the glow of God coming up through there. Now, question, what does he look like? He's above the mercy seat. You happen to walk in. Pretty soon you'll be dead. But before you're dead, you get to see what he looks like. What's he look like? Shekinah glory. What's he look like? Light? Is that it? Huh? Cloud. Yes, absolutely cloud. What kind of cloud? Is it a, a cumulus cloud? Or what's a cirrus cloud? Or is it a cloud of smoke? Shekinah glory, I have smoke and I have light. Where's that in the Bible? Genesis 15, that's correct. You will see Genesis 15 if you walk into the Holy of Holies on the 10th day of the 7th month. So, remember, as I just said, Nadab and Abihu, they put the wrong fire and they got themselves killed because of it. And he makes sure that the context for Aaron is don't do that. Do not come in just any time. If you do, you're going to die. You have to come in on this day, the 10th day of the 7th month, and you got to be wearing the special clothes. Hey, the special clothes were the holy linen garments, the hat and the sash and the white vestments. And before you do that, by the way, though, you have to make sure you're clean because you're filthy, dirty. And I don't want you coming into my place because you're going to get killed if you don't come in on the right day. You got to have the right clothes. And before you put the right clothes on, you got to be washed by the ashes of the red heifer on the 3rd day and the 7th day in the 10 days before you come here. Called the days of preparation or the awesome days. So far, so good, right? Why are we really going through this? Because you wouldn't have remembered it. And Catherine is here from New York, and we have to catch her up, and we only got a few more minutes. So then he The high priest, he atones for, he has an offering for himself and his house. He has an atonement offering because himself and his house are filthy. He has an atonement offering for the holy place and the tabernacle itself where he's doing this because the holy place and the tabernacle is filthy. How come the holy place and the tabernacle is filthy? Because it's on earth and the whole earth is defiled. How come? People, you ever see Charlie Brown, right? Favorite character in Charlie Brown? Not Snoopy. Yes, it was Pigpen. I loved Pigpen. Pigpen defiled everything he touched. Okay, we are Pigpen exponentially. We're 10 to the 6th Pigpen. Everything we touch is defiled. And when I say we, I mean humanity. So offer for the holy place and the tabernacle and the altar. People come near anything, they defile it. You had to have an offering for the priest. What did we learn about the priest? The priests are filthy. If you learn one thing from me in the last couple of weeks, priests are filthy. Expect them to be filthy. Quit worshiping pastors and priests and all that stuff. I know they look cool. I've often thought that I'd get some fancy uniform with ribbons and things on it. And I loved it when the bright light came through. And these guys that open up these mirrored suits and people fall down and everybody throws money at them and goes whatever they go and foam at the mouth. What is that? That is just falling for the oldest trick in the book, and it just drives me nuts. Quit worshiping these people. They're just stealing your money because you're what? Yeah, that's the word I want. And then we have to offer atonement for the people. So he's got to offer for himself in his house. He's got to offer for the holy place, the tabernacle, and the altar. He's got to offer for the priests. And he's got to have an atonement offering for the people because of the dirt. And I had an interesting thought come from a gentleman that comes through every now and then and lives out of the country. He calls it the conservation of filth, which I thought was very well done, and I promised him I'd steal it from him. But if your car is dirty, how do you clean it? You wash it with a hose. Where'd the dirt go? On the ground. How do you get the dirt off the ground? You wash it into the neighbor's yard. Yes, exactly what you do. Think of it differently this way. You have a tool that's covered with grease and you want to restore it to perfect cleanliness. How do you do it? You get a rag and clean it off? What happened to the rag? The dirt just moved, right? If I have something that's going to be cleaned, something's got to be made dirty. Does that make sense? Conservation of filth. It's fascinating. And so you can make the application, right? Your filth has to go somewhere. Where's it go? His blood had to become what? Really? Be careful. Okay. Because of uncleanness, because of filth, we are in need of very, very much cleaning. There's only one cleaning agent that will do it, and that is the blood of Christ. Okay, there's another one that will do it. What is it? There's only one cleaning agent that will clean you and you live. There's another cleaning agent, but it ain't gonna go so good for you. What's that cleaning agent? Fire. Yes, he either cleans it with blood or he burns it off, but he's gonna get rid of it. Now, and then we have the one fire that is allowed. The one fire. We can't have strange fire, Nadab, Abihu, you die. There's only one fire you can have, and you bring that into the Holy of Holies. It's a sweet incense, and it covers the whole area as well so that you're hidden by it, and you better bring it in, this one fire, or you'll die. Don't bring strange fire. What that's telling us, as I said last week, is don't come before God without this incense, which is who? That's Christ. Don't come in there without Him, because if you do, you'll die. So don't come without the right fire, and don't come empty. Don't bring another religion to God on Judgment Day. Don't come with anything else, anybody else but Christ or you'll die. That's obvious. He poured that into Israel. Don't come in here thinking there are many paths to the mountain or God will accept any, all kinds of, He won't. One way only, one fire, one incense, Christ. And don't come empty handed. What would we call empty handed? Atheism. Don't come empty handed and don't come in with something else. Now back to the goats. Almost done. The goat upon the lot, the goat that, upon whom the lot for YHVH fell, that goat is killed. And all of the sins of Israel are put on that goat, and that goat is killed. And there is atonement now for all of the sins of the nation of Israel. There is a satisfaction. There is a price paid. The word is called expiation. The sins of the nation of Israel are all on the goat for YHVH, and the price is paid. The sins are completely expiated. Learn the word expiated. It'll be on your test next week as well. Bring a pen and a notebook. You guys going to be here next week? Okay, you'll have to mail it in. The sins are completely expiated, satisfied, atoned for, price paid. Now, the goat for Azazel is released alive. And you will read about Israel's innovations, their pollutions. They push the goat off a cliff. That's a recent post-crucifixion thing that they do. They have flags and all this other stuff and these stations. That is not Leviticus 16. Those are things they added to it. Would you imagine that man would add something to God's edicts? See, oh, they do it all the time. We still do it. We've probably done it here. When we catch ourselves, what should we do? Get rid of it. That's right. Anyway, the goat was intended to be released alive and stay alive. And this second goat is now presented in front of this other person who is in the wilderness. And as you know, I take the position that that other person that the goat is presented to is Satan. So I have a lot that says YHVH on it, and I have a lot that says Satan on it. I put the lot on that goat. That goat's killed because it's God's. That goat's released alive because it's Satan's. It's presented to Satan. It's not his goat, but it's presented before him. Does that make sense? If you take the time to delve into this second goat, you're going to find a great debate here. As I said last week, I side with J.H. Kurtz and a man named Hinstenberg. And Kurtz will admit to following Hinstenberg, whom he credits with paving the way for the true vindication and explanation of this second goat. And he actually gives him credit. And if you read these guys, that's an amazing thing. They don't like to give each other credit. He still thought Hinstenberg didn't get it completely right, like Kurtz did. But he thought he paved the way. And the obvious question to them, they struggled with these two goats. And they struggled over the fact that all the sins were gone, so what was on the other goat? That becomes the question. Let me read it to you. It's from 1863 when it was written by Kurtz. It is incomprehensible why sin, which had already been expiated, what's expiated mean? It's going to be on test. Okay, it's been paid for. It is incomprehensible why sin, which had already been paid for in the highest, strongest, and most comprehensible manner through the blood and the death of the first goat, should have to be subjected to a second goat, should have to be subjected to a fresh, and in any case, a weaker expiation. So he's saying essentially this, why do I put what's on the second goat? Why is it released alive? I got rid of all the sins, so one thing can't be on that second goat. What's that? Can't be sin on it. That's what he's saying. So what's on it? And that's the point. In other words, the sin is gone. All of it is gone with the death and the shed blood of the first goat. There is no sin left to put on the second goat. So what do? They lay hands on the second goat and they let it go. What did they put on the second goat? Is the question. And that's why that goat's alive, you see. He's got to be alive. If I put sin on the goat, what happens to the goat? Dies. The goat's alive. What do you now know about that goat? There's no sin on that goat. It's still alive, isn't it? See, that's the rule. If you have sin on you, you're going to die. If we clean the sin off of you, you're alive. It's pretty simple. See, that's why it's released or sent to Azazel, which I think is Satan. And the New Testament complement, don't have time to do it, is 1 Peter 3:18, where Christ descends and makes a proclamation. And there's three views here. We'll cover it next week. Is he talking to the fallen angels? I believe he is. Some will say he's talking to the humans in Sheol, in torments, where the rich man was, for example. But I think it's the fallen angels in Tartarus. I'll give my view next week. But he didn't preach to them to try to save them. He proclaimed to them what had happened with his death. Okay? Kurtz will say that there's something on the second goat. What's on the second goat is expiated sin. I find that fascinating. What is expiated sin? Nothing. Yeah. But that's what he'll say. Expiated sin is on the alive goat. And that's what was proclaimed by Christ. The blood, the death of the, when he went down, the blood, the death of the real goat, the Son of God, the I Am, the Messiah, the Ancient of Days. He makes the proclamation of what happened. Two things happened. Those that were cleansed by his blood are alive, and those uncovered would now be judged and die. The second death. That's his proclamation. And what is that? He makes a proclamation. Some will live, some will die. What is that? You should yell at me what that is. What is that? Some will live. Some will die. That's Genesis 15. You see, because all can't live and all can't die. Some will live, some will die. Why can't all live? See, some will have blood on them and some will not. Why can't all live? Why is it only the ones with blood on them live? Why can't the rest live? Why can't everybody be saved? Yes, if all live, there's no justice. Why can't all die? If all die, there's no mercy. There's no solution to sin. If there is no solution to sin, what is sin? Omnipotent. What is God? Not omnipotent. There must be a solution to sin. Do you see one of the fivefold lies of Satan here? One of the fivefold lies is that God is not omnipotent because he has no solution to sin. Well, he does have a solution to sin, and he is omnipotent. Does that make any sense to anybody but me? Maybe not. Next week. Perfect love and perfect justice would be resolved in the person, the work, the death, the blood of God, the Son, Jesus Christ, and he would make the proclamation that he had cleansed sin. And those with he would go down to the angels with expiated sin on him, which is nothing. And if he had solved sin, then he's omnipotent. He's removed one of the lies. Now, really fast for next week, because I did go a little longer on my permineralized than I wanted. Almost done. Musicians can sneak forward. I'm almost done. I promise. Absolutely promise. I want to read Leviticus 17. You should never have a Sunday where you're not reading Leviticus. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron, to his sons, and to all the children of Israel, and say to them, This is the thing which the Lord has commanded, saying, Whatever man of the house of Israel kills an ox or a lamb or a goat in the camp, and who kills it outside the camp, and does not bring it to the door of the tabernacle of meeting to offer an offering to the Lord before the tabernacle of the Lord, the guilt of bloodshed shall be imputed to that man. In other words, don't do any offerings outside in the city of Israel. If you do, and you don't bring them to me in the tabernacle, what's your problem? Keeps going on. They'll be cut off. So if you offer a sacrifice outside of the city of Jerusalem, you don't bring the sacrifice to the temple. You kill it out there, but you better bring the blood into the priest. In other words, don't you dare sacrifice anything without bringing the blood to Jerusalem and let that priest do it by sprinkling it. Go down to 17:10. And whatever man of the house of Israel or of the strangers who dwell among you who eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut him off from among the people. Is that good news for the blood eaters? No. You shall not eat the blood of any flesh, for the life of all blood is its blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. Now my favorite verse in all of John. I do like the one where he says to Peter, makes Peter answer the questions again. So if I had to pick another verse, I would pick John 6:53. I'll find it here soon. Then Jesus said to them, Most assuredly I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life. One place Leviticus, don't drink blood. One place in John, Christ says, drink blood. You're going to die if you drink blood. You're going to die if you don't drink blood. How do you reconcile that, huh? How do you reconcile don't drink blood in Leviticus with the communion service? What is the wine represent? It's a symbol of blood. In fact, Catholics will tell you what. Transubstantiation. It actually turns to blood inside you. It's a great miracle. I've always wanted to pump stomachs. It's another complete lecture. But how do I reconcile don't drink blood, drink blood? If you drink blood, you die. If you don't drink blood, you die. Got to put those together. When do we do that? Next week. Let's stand and be dismissed.